that's why we created a separate cardiorenal service at our hospital, is because these patients are hard. They're complicated. They're difficult. They still scare me, and I've been doing this for years now.
That's Dr. Nyan Arora, a nephrologist at University of Washington, and we are so excited to have him as one of our discussants to help us through what can be a scary topic for most, cardiorenal syndrome. Welcome to the Core IM 5 Pearls podcast, bringing you high-yield, evidence-based pearls. This is Dr. Shreya Trivedi, and I'm joined by...
This is Dr. Andrew Ling, a second-year internal medicine resident at BIDMC.
Yes, and let's go over what we'll be covering today. Test yourself by pausing after each of the 5 questions. Remember, the more you test yourself, the deeper your learning gains.
Pearl 1. Make sure the renal dysfunction is not from something else.
What are you expecting to see in a urine analysis in a patient with AKI from purely cardiorenal syndrome?
Pearl 2. Practical tidbits on loop diuretics.
What's the difference in bioavailability, duration of action, and outcomes between furosemide, torsemide, and bumetanide?
Pearl 3, assessing diuretic response.
How can spot urine sodium measurements be used to assess diuretic response?
Pearl 4, approaching diuretic resistance.
What types of agents do you think about to add to the loop diuretic to augment diuresis, and in what situations?
Pearl 5, don't be afraid of medical therapy because of CKD.
Should you stop RAS inhibitors or SGLT2 inhibitors when the creatinine reaches a certain threshold? Why or why not?
All right, Shreya, well, let's get into it with a case. You have Miss CR, a 67-year-old patient who has a history of heart failure with an EF around 40%. In CKD, she comes into the ED with shortness of breath and weight gain. She takes torsemide 40 milligrams once daily at home, but she's not been urinating as much as she normally does.
Ah, so it sounds like she needs some diuresis with that volume overload.
Yeah, for sure. But her creatinine's 2.5 from a baseline of around 1.7. You're feeling like it's probably cardiorenal and you do want a diurese, but the degree of her AKI is making your team a little queasy about just pulling the trigger and how to manage her other medication.
Yeah, this sounds so familiar, especially with that creatinine being up from 1.7 to that mid 2 range. I think makes anyone really nervous.
Yeah, for sure. Let's step back for a second. What do we actually mean when we say the AKI is cardiorenal?
We're talking acute heart dysfunction causing acute kidney dysfunction, right? So that's your classic patients in the hospital with decompensated heart failure, and you see that their creatinine's up.
We also sat down with Dr. Nicole Babe, one of the cardiologists with a special interest in the cardiorenal population, the University of Michigan.
When we say cardiorenal, most of the time we're referring to chronic kidney disease or acute on chronic kidney disease that's related to kidney congestion and or a low flow stage.
So when we have this low flow state, I think a lot of people think about low cardiac output, right? I think a lot of people get that when there's a low cardiac output, that causes a prerenal AKI since the heart's not pumping enough blood forward to the kidney. But Andrew, how do we get congestion without that cardiac output problem leading to that cardiorenal picture?
It's a great question, Shreya, and I was looking into it a little more. So when we talk about congestion, there's extra pressure on the venous side of the renal capillary bed, kind of where the blood is leaving the kidney. That venous congestion makes it more difficult for blood to travel through the whole kidney itself. And the exit for the blood on the venous side just gets all jammed up.
Okay. So in cardiorenal syndrome, even when your heart is giving you good output and forward flow, just having backup and higher pressures on the venous side can also block how much blood is actually making it through the kidney. And that may be more of a driver.
Right. And I think this is an important point because at least when I learned about AKI and heart failure back in med school, the focus was always on the heart not getting enough blood forward to the kidney. But actually, the forward flow is often fine in most of our patients. And really, it's the venous congestion that's probably more important. And our reviewers also emphasize that the relationship may be bidirectional. Depending on the case, it can be either the heart or the kidney, or maybe something else entirely that's affecting both organs in parallel. And our reviewers emphasize that the relationship may be bidirectional. Depending on the case, it can be either the heart or the kidney or something else entirely that's affecting both organs that can be driving this cardiorenal syndrome.
That is really good to kind of get that pathophys backing. Why don't we go back to Ms. CR, Ms. Creatinine? Her creatinine's going up. She has some cardiorenal physiology, we think, either from venous congestion or maybe some poor forward flow also contributing. Either way, you know, how can we feel sure about this, except for really trying to get a good volume exam, which bless everyone's soul trying to do? What else can make us feel sure?
So what you're looking at is classic cardiorenal syndrome is going to be you get your urinalysis and it's bland. You don't have protein, you don't have blood. You can have hyaline casts, and that can actually help support that diagnosis, but you're not going to have granular casts, red cell casts, other things. There's no rule that says you can't have two things at the same time, right? So you could have cardiorenal syndrome superimposed on other things. People can come in with tubular injury. Maybe they're in cardiogenic shock and they're hypotensive and they have hypoperfusion injury to the kidney. Maybe somebody gave them antibiotics a week or two ago and they have interstitial nephritis. Maybe they got that cardiac cath a while ago and they have atheroembolic disease.
So it sounds like when we see a creatinine up in someone with heart failure, we should ask, am I dealing with just cardiorenal syndrome? Or am I dealing with an intrinsic renal process or something else entirely?
Right. So I think it's so easy once an AKI or CKD label is in that one-liner not to go back and rethink other insults.
Right. And even sometimes the simplest thing we can forget in a busy clinic day or during an emergency room visit is to chart review and see if we've ever gotten a UA on this patient before or a urine albumin creatinine ratio.
One of my patients who I've been taking care of for a long time has coronary disease and heart failure with mildly reduced ejection fraction. And his creatinine had been sort of creeping up over the years. And it was one of these things where I went back and said, oh, I've seen him for 5 years and his creatinine was 1.5 and now it's closer to 2. And I was really kind of wondering, like I had been, again, thinking that it was all cardiorenal. And then I got a urine sample and he had proteinuria and he actually went on to have a biopsy and had FSGS. And now is on PD.
Wow. Now that is a case I will remember. Imagine finding FSGS kind of out of nowhere.
It is kind of wild. And I think it's an important reminder for us too, Shreya, that the common chronic risk factors for heart disease, things like hypertension, diabetes, vascular disease, are also the same common risk factors for intrinsic chronic kidney disease. So there's a lot of reasons for these patients to maybe have something else going on.
So to recap, in classic cardiorenal syndrome, there will be no signs of intrinsic kidney injury, aka there's going to be a bland urine. Hyaline casts are okay, but there should be no new protein, blood, or other cells in the urine if the AKI is completely cardiorenal.
Right. And of course, there are those people that sometimes have transient proteinuria where you may want to at least repeat the urine albumin or leave it as a transitional issue for the outpatient setting. But don't let it be something that falls off your radar. It may be some harbinger of some other intrinsic process, which can really change someone's management, especially as an outpatient. All right, so let's get back to Ms. CR. You get her urine back, and it's pretty bland. And again, meaning no blood, no cell casts, no protein. She seems pretty volume overloaded on your exam, but thankfully she's not cool or looking like a patient who's in cardiogenic shock.
Yeah, so since she's volume overloaded, we're probably going to reach for some diuresis to help her feel better, get some blood moving through those kidneys. So let's get to some practical tidbits on IV diuretics and then move on to oral diuretics after.
So I know based on the dose trial, we can feel safe with an aggressive approach of taking her home diuretic dose and give 2.5 times that amount by IV dosing per day while she's in the hospital. For Ms. CR, she's on torsemide 40 at home. So that would be aiming for 200 of IV Lasix throughout the day.
Right. So with that 200 of IV Lasix, should that be broken up into boluses or a drip? And I'm curious what our experts had to say about which one may be better.
No study has really shown a difference between the two. I have my own reasons for liking bolus dosing more. I mean, I think it gives the macula densa a bit of a break, but again, that's personal preference.
Oh, I like the sound of that, giving the macula densa a break. We all can need a break from time to time. I can get behind that.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, I feel like the classic situation here is one attending sticks with bolusing, and then the next one takes over service and says, all right, start the drip. It's good to know there's no actual difference that's been shown.
Yeah, it's a dealer's choice, right, between bolus and drip. Okay, What about the actual IV diuretic options? How do we think through those?
So in the hospital, pick your IV medication. So torsemide is oral. Generally, you're probably going to go with an IV option when somebody needs more acute therapy. I personally don't think there's any difference in IV furosemide or IV bumetanide, except for that the IV bumetanide allows people to use higher doses, quote unquote, of loop diuretics than they're comfortable with IV furosemide.
You know, Shreya, I tried reading into why people feel more comfortable with higher equivalent doses of IV bumetanide. It wasn't really that clear to me, whether it's just the doses that have been improved for Bumex or in the single digits. Maybe it feels unsettling to give people doses of Lasix in the several hundreds.
Yeah, it's, I think, a psychological thing, right? The numbers can definitely fool us, but I think we have to remember the relative potencies, which we'll hopefully lay out in an infographic that we'll attach to this episode that Dr. Ral Mishwari, a nephrologist, created. I think one other difference we should point out between Lasix and bumetanide is that the bumetanide drip can give terrible myalgias and diffuse pains.
Yeah, I remember seeing this on my heart failure patients when they're up to 2 or 3 an hour on the drip and they're just feeling horrible. They're pressing their call button, asking their nurse, can you stop this?
Oh, definitely something to watch out for. Okay, so with that, why don't we then transition to the oral loop diuretics, and especially since we have to think about what doses we want to discharge people on once they leave the hospital.
A common reason for admission would be, I'm taking my furosemide, but instead of kicking in within an hour, as it should, it's taking 2 or 3 hours, and I'm just not urinating that much, and I went up and up on the dose, and it still wasn't working, particularly with furosemide being less bioavailable than bumetanide and torsemide. That's a common issue.
Okay, and as a quick review, when we talk about bioavailability, we mean how much of that medication actually gets into the circulation and is available to the system, right? So when we think about IV meds, it's 100% bioavailable because it's going directly into the blood and you don't have to worry about wonky absorption or gut issues getting in the way.
Yeah, and I was really surprised reading about it that oral furosemide's bioavailability is all over the place, anywhere between 10 to 90 or 100%. 50% on average?
Man, that is wild, Andrew. Like, I did know that the bioavailability is all over the place with furosemide, but I didn't know it could be as bad as 10%.
Particularly if someone's come into the hospital and they've been on Lasix and it hasn't been working for them, then most of the time I will switch to torsemide or bumetanide.
So the good news is that oral torsemide and bumetanide have a bioavailability that's usually above 80%. I think that would make anyone feel like those were more reliable.
I love torsemide, right? I love torsemide. Again, pharmacokinetics makes a lot of sense. It has a longer duration of action. It's more predictable in terms of its bioavailability when it comes to, obviously, the oral dosing. And there was a study on this. It's called the TRANSFORM-HF trial. And I thought this was going to be a cakewalk for torsemide, right? I thought this was like, I don't know, Super Bowl 42. I thought this was Giants versus Patriots. You know, torsemide's going to blow furosemide out of the water, but that's why you do the studies. That's why you play the game. And the pharmacokinetics didn't match up. And actually, there was no difference in the two.
Okay, that soundbite might be a sore subject for some of our colleagues in Boston. But man, what a shocker. Despite the pharmacokinetics, when we study this in, you know, the real world, there was no difference between those who are hospitalized with decompensated heart failure who were discharged with oral torsemide versus oral furosemide.
I have a lot of issues with that study. They were looking at mortality outcomes, which I just don't think you're going to see a mortality difference when you're looking at two agents of the same class like that. I would have liked to see kind of other outcomes. That being said, there's nothing I can show you to say that one is better than the other, except for the fact that I just like torsemide better.
Our viewers also mentioned some other issues with the study, including a lot of crossover between the two groups. And I'm with Dr. Rora. It feels like mortality is probably not the right thing to look at. I wonder if maybe they would have been able to show a difference in heart failure exacerbations or rehospitalizations, maybe.
Yeah, I hope someone's studying it. Hopefully there's an NIH grant cooking somewhere looking into just all that.
I hope so, because that would change a lot of things for a lot of patients. Just a few other things to mention about the oral diuretics. Torsemide has the longest duration of action, as mentioned, anywhere from 6 to 16 hours, so it can usually be dosed once a day. Bumetanide has the shortest duration with 4 to 6 hours, so multiple times a day dosing is usual for that.
Yeah, and that's especially good to keep in mind with bumetanide, right? Is our patient going to be compliant with multiple times a day dosing?
Right. I think it's good to keep in mind for Lasix too. It's in the middle of the two durations, but still on the shorter side in the 6 to 8 hour range.
Yeah. And then the last couple of things to maybe sway us towards torsemide. I didn't know this before this episode, but turns out torsemide's absorption is less affected by food intake, unlike the other two diuretics. And then on top of that, torsemide's been shown to have less hypokalemia than furosemide in some studies. And the thought behind that is that torsemide actually has some aldosterone antagonism effects, which is pretty cool.
Wow. I didn't know either of those things. I was already on team torsemide. I love using it in my outpatients.
Yeah. Nice. I love that. Okay. So while we're on the topic of oral diuretics, what dose should we discharge patients on? I feel like that's always like a guessing game, kind of.
For sure. And different people always pick different numbers. Do you just discharge the patient on the same dose they were on before, or do you go up because maybe the home dose just isn't enough anymore?
With that said, whenever you discharge someone from the hospital, the close follow-up is, of course, critically important because it's very easy to overshoot. And we often find that after you kickstart someone with IV diuretics, their PO diuretic sensitivity will improve again. And it can often be a moving target as to what dose they need to be on.
I really appreciate hearing that and that the PO diuretic sensitivity might actually improve, which makes sense because hopefully you've gotten rid of some of that gut edema that was affecting your absorption.
Yeah, that makes sense. You know, I think I've certainly increased the oral Lasix dose or torsemide dosing on discharge without really taking into account, oh, maybe their diuretic sensitivity improving.
Well, don't beat yourself up so much about it, Trey. I think everyone just picks a number and the most important thing is to see what happens after. And I think this is also a good reminder to think about what's bringing your patient in. Maybe if they're coming in after missing some days of diuretics or because of dietary indiscretion, then sticking to their old dose might be okay. But if something else is going on, you might feel like you should increase their dose or even change their diuretics entirely.
Yeah, and maybe again, as you said, the biggest takeaway is to discharge them with really close follow-up that can check up on their weight, their kidney function, make sure their symptoms are in a good homeostasis with that diuretic dose.
So why don't we summarize then? With IV diuresis, it's dealer's choice since there's no difference between IV furosemide and bumetanide. But bumetanide's much more potent, milligram per milligram, so it's easier to reach for higher equivalent doses.
Yeah. And then when it comes to oral dosing, furosemide has a pretty big range in terms of bioavailability from 10% to 100%. And on average, our patients may be getting around 50% of that furosemide dose. Compare that to torsemide and bumetanide, where we can feel comfortable that over 80% of those diuretics will get into the circulation.
The duration of effects between them are also different, with bumetanide and furosemide being shorter acting and torsemide being the longest acting. Usually this means oral bumetanide should be dosed twice a day, while you can stick with once a day for oral torsemide.
The holidays are sneaking up fast, and I've got to say, I love Uncommon Goods. As the name suggests, it's full of one-of-a-kind gifts you won't find anywhere else. For example, I've definitely gotten stuck years before on things to get my nieces or nephews. It feels like they have everything, right? But Uncommon Goods has things that are truly different, thoughtful, high-quality, handmade often, made right here in the U.S. And there's something for everyone, moms, dads, teens, foodies, aka all my cousins, even gardening stuff for my dad. So I found so many fun personal ideas I haven't seen before. And if you shop at Uncommon Goods, you're not just checking something off a list, you're also supporting artists, small independent businesses, and many of their products are made in small batches. So if something catches your eyes, definitely scoop it up before it sells out. And I love this. With every purchase, they donate $1 to any nonprofit partner of your choice. So don't wait. Make this holiday the year you give something truly unforgettable. To get 15% off your next gift, go to uncommongoods.com/coream. That's uncommongoods.com/coream to get 15% off. Don't miss out on this limited offer. And as they say, Uncommon Goods, because we're all out of the ordinary. And now, back to the episode.
Now, Andrew, I guess the question is, how do we know we're getting the diuretic response we may want?
The classic metrics we use, which is going to be cumulative output, right? And then weights. They unfortunately haven't been shown to be super predictive of outcomes. I think part of the reason is that it's hard to accurately measure those things in the hospital.
Oh, yeah. All those times where that morning weight's kind of like up and the next day down, and then the patient's also being charted as net negative 1.5 liters, but that's hard to believe because it looks like they only took in 200 cc's, which I don't know about that. I think with all that being said, I think my all-time favorite clinical hack to move care forward is to look at a urine sodium to see if I'm giving an effective diuretic dose.
The metric we use personally, and it is supported by data, is looking at a urine sodium which is a spot sample 1 to 2 hours after you give them their diuretic. I personally use a threshold of 70, so urine sodium of 70. Studies have been anywhere from 50 to 100, okay? Those studies have been, they hit the door, I give them a loop diuretic after they've emptied their bladder, I check a urine sample, and it's whatever threshold. Plus, it allows me to escalate therapy more quickly, right? If I do have an intervention, check a urine sodium 2 hours later, I can very quickly increase my meds, titrate, do whatever I need to do versus waiting, let's say, a day to see what their weight's doing or whatever classic metric you're using.
Yeah, one thing I also do when I use this is to write in the Lasix order to have the patient empty their bladder before giving the dose and then order the urine sodium to be collected 1 to 2 hours later.
Oof, yeah, I've definitely probably interpreted a urine sodium from the first void after a Lasix dose, and it's probably old urine that was like sitting in a bladder and probably not really reflective of the Lasix dose. It just also makes me think, Andrew, if there's some other things we should be mindful of when we're interpreting that urine sodium.
So you have to be careful because urine sodium, again, is influenced by the concentration or dilution of your urine. And so if I have somebody who's only peeing 1 liter, I really don't need a urine sodium because that patient is not responding well no matter what. And the urine sodium might be, you know, falsely reassuring just because the urine's concentrated. Similarly, if I have somebody urinating 10 liters, I probably don't need a urine sodium because it might be falsely lower just because it's diluted.
Okay, that's a great point that I don't think about often. Concentrated urine can make the urine sodium falsely high, giving some false reassurance that our diuretic dose is right. And then dilute urine, on the other hand, can make the urine sodium seem lower, and we could be falsely disappointed.
Yeah, and maybe all of that just goes back to the larger hidden message in all of this, which is the urine sodium is also just one data point and needs to be taken into context of total output, weight, symptoms, and all. At least it's an objective data point that can give you some more confidence.
Yeah, I like reaching for the urine sodium, especially when our patients are incontinent or for whatever reason, only able to get bed weights.
Other things that can influence your urine sodium in general is metabolic alkalosis can do that. You have to deliver bicarbonate distally, so with that comes sodium, so you can influence your urine sodium with bicarbonaturia. The other thing is certain medications used in the hospital, one of the biggest ones is piperacillin. So if you have somebody on piperacillin tazobactam, the piperacillin pulls sodium with it.
Yeah, so I guess one way to think about it is sodium is like kind of like our tag-along friend that like comes along for the ride with piperacillin and the elevated bicarb metabolic alkalosis.
It's a fun way to think about it. And I'm just thinking a little more too. I imagine another to be mindful of for the urine sodium is cirrhosis, where patients have some extra volume in their abdomen, their legs, but they can still have a low urine sodium even when you're giving them diuresis.
Yeah, that's a good throwback to the hyponatremia episode where one of our nephrologists was like, yeah, look, in patients with cirrhosis, their RAS system is always going to be activated. They have a low SVR, systemic vascular resistance. And when the RAS system's up, body's going to retain that sodium and your urine sodium is going to be low.
Well, I guess it was always too good to be true for the urine sodium to be completely foolproof.
Yeah, yeah, as much as I love it.
But I think, you know, it sounds like it can still be really helpful when you can trust it. And just to put it out there, if you look at all your data, including the urine sodium, and feel like your patient's not responding to their current dose, the general advice is to double your loop diuretic as a next step.
Yeah, and that brings me to something else I was hoping we could touch on, which is the creatinine, right? I think we're all kind of like nervous to see what that creatinine comes back as the next day. And I wonder if there's a good way to think about some of these creatinine fluctuations we see in cardiorenal syndrome.
Yeah, I'd definitely like to talk about that too, because I know often we say diuresis through a creatinine bump, but I'm with you. I'm really not sure how much is too much.
So the dose trial showed that if your creatinine got better, you had worse mortality than if your creatinine got worse during a hospitalization for decompensated heart failure. And multiple trials like that showing that.
Oh, wow. I can't tell you how many times I've heard, oh, the creatinine's getting better. That's reassuring. And it sounds like that might not always be true.
A creatinine rise of 30% or less, I barely look at, right? So that I kind of give them and won't pause. Once it gets to that, and I personally am a little braver. So 30% is what's shown in most of the studies. You saw this bimodal distribution of outcomes in the dose trials. If your creatinine got worse by 50% or more, you started to see this worsening in heart outcomes.
30% and even maybe up to a 50% bump. That sounds like way more than what I'm usually comfortable with for a creatinine rise.
Yeah, yeah. And just to clarify, we're talking about here a 30 or 50% creatinine bump from their baseline. Okay. So this is not the creatinine they came in to the hospital with.
If you have a creatinine of 3 and it goes to 4, it's increased by 33%. It scares people, right?
Yeah. I think when there's a creatinine number that's higher, say in the 2s, 3s, it's just really hard to appreciate what exactly a 30% rise in that creatinine is. And just to hammer home what creatinine bumps we tolerate, let's use an analogy and think about in the outpatient setting what we tolerate when it comes to RAS inhibitors and SGLT2 initiations.
And what I tell people is, you see this in a lot of other places in medicine that you accept, and we need to do the same thing for active decongestion. When you guys give people RAS inhibitors, the classic board question is, how much of a rise do you tolerate? It's 30%. SGLT2 inhibitors, everyone's favorite medication, same thing, right? You get a creatinine bump. 30% is kind of the quoted tolerated amount, but that leads to better long outcomes. Blood pressure control.
Yeah, in these situations with RAS inhibitors and SGLT2s, the thought is you're putting less pressure on each glomerulus to be working overtime. So it really just looks like your kidney's not working as well when that's not really true.
Right. With these medications, we're helping the glomerulus work less hard, and it's actually protecting them from getting too worn out in the long term.
Yeah. And so I think the key point here really is that a creatinine rise, like in those situations, doesn't always mean nephrons are injured. And in the case of decongestion, another reason the creatinine might just look worse is because you're hemoconcentrating the creatinine in your blood if you're diuresing well.
It's also really easy to point to studies that say, look, if your creatinine goes up by 30%, 50%, that's okay. But when you have that patient in front of you with all these different things they're telling you by history, their labs are all nuts, and you don't feel confident about your volume status, it's very different than in a trial setting. In between, I'm still doing my due diligence. Every day, if I'm seeing this creatinine go up, maybe I need to respin the urine. Maybe they have another process going on. All the different things we mentioned previously for acute kidney injury can still happen. But as long as I'm not seeing any other issues, I keep going.
And again, some spaced repetition from Pearl 1, right? We should be constantly reassessing other kidney insults, especially in the hospital.
Let's summarize about assessing diuretic response. Outside of our traditional weights and I's and O's, an elevated spot urine sodium taken 1 to 2 hours after giving diuretic is a good marker of diuretic response. Some of our experts use a urine sodium threshold of 70, but different studies have any number between 50 to 100 as the cutoff. And you should have the patient empty their bladder before giving the diuretic and then collect the sample in an ideal world.
Okay, yes. As much as I love the urine sodium, it is not foolproof, especially if someone's urinating a lot or a little. That urine sodium may not be as accurate, and you probably, in those situations, already know how the person's responding. It may be more helpful in more of those gray areas when it's combined with urine volume. And other things to look out for in interpreting it is there metabolic alkalosis? Are they on certain meds like Piptazo that can make the urine sodium falsely high and reassure us that your diuretic dose is effective?
And the other thing we talked about was creatinine rises during diuresis. Patients with decompensated heart failure whose creatinine initially went up 30% from their baseline actually did better than those whose creatinine went down right away with diuresis. This rise is usually not because of actual kidney tubular injury. All right, so we follow the urine output and urine sodium from a CR, and unfortunately, we just aren't having much response. Her Lasix gets doubled, tripled, eventually she's on a drip, and she's urinating maybe 1 liter per day, with the urine sodium still low in the 40 to 50 range. What do we do now?
Yeah, so let's talk about this. Diuretic resistance. What's our approach here?
The first step is, does my patient have flow? If you don't have appropriate renal perfusion, it doesn't matter what you do with your diuretics.
Okay, another reminder about diagnostic timeouts, right? If we're cranking up the diuretics and not making much headway, could there be something else that's affecting kidney perfusion, like cardiac output or ascites?
Right. Let's say here we are confident that we don't have issues like low cardiac output or ascites impacting flow to the kidneys. I feel like at this point, I've heard different people reach for metolazone or chlorothiazide or some other boosters, but I don't really have a great framework for how to think about that.
Oftentimes in outpatient setting with heart failure patients who are diuretic resistant, we'll use metolazone, which has a really long half-life.
It is kind of like your glargine of diuretics. It's your long-acting, you know, nice in that way versus chlorothiazide does work quicker, right? It's IV. You're getting it, it has a rapid onset of action, but it only lasts about 2 hours or so. And so there's reasons why metolazone may be actually favorable.
Okay. And then clinically, there's no real difference between the effect of metolazone or chlorothiazide. I think really the difference to know is that IV chlorothiazide is faster onset. Another practical point is that it's more expensive.
I hear you, Shreya, though I feel like despite the data, I've seen a lot of attendings who at least stylistically prefer chlorothiazide. I think maybe just because it feels like it works faster, and since it's IV, you're not messing with oral absorption.
Yeah, I get that. I get that. And then there's another booster that I hear people talking about or tweeting about every now and then or Xing about, acetazolamide. And I guess that's something good that we can reach for, especially if that bicarb's starting to go up and they're still volume overloaded.
There was a paper in the New England Journal a year or two ago that suggested that it has, you know, benefit in acute heart failure. It's nice for people who are alkalotic.
Right. It looks like that trial that Dr. Bave mentioned is the ADVOR trial. It randomized patients to loop diuretics plus acetazolamide or loop diuretic alone.
The acetazolamide arm did have increased fractional excretion of sodium. They had decreased length of stay, and more patients were decongested, I believe, at the 48-hour mark compared to the control group. So I love acetazolamide. I will tell you, I absolutely love acetazolamide. We started using it several years ago, and I think it works really well.
Sounds like acetazolamide's really got a lot of fans. I'll be sure to think about it earlier next time, especially if the patient's bicarb's in the high 30s or near 40, those COPD patients, and they're still volume overloaded.
Yeah, definitely haven't used it as much, and hopefully we'll remember to try to reach for it more in these sticky situations.
Of the diuretic resistance boosters that we talked about, at least in this episode, we have metolazone, chlorothiazide, acetazolamide. What types of things should we be watching out for when we use these?
Some people are just so sensitive to it that you just volume deplete them rapidly and they develop AKI. You also have to worry about electrolytes.
You want their potassium certainly greater than 4. There's actually, you know, data to show that hypokalemia is an independent risk factor for diuretic resistance. And so, you know, electrolyte monitoring and repleting these appropriately, adding potassium-sparing diuretics early, you know, whatever you want to do to kind of maintain electrolyte balance is important.
We've definitely talked about keeping the potassium of a 4 when we're like worried about arrhythmias and things like that. There's a whole hypokalemia episode on it. But never thought about hypokalemia as actually making you respond worse to diuretics.
So particularly when we start talking about things like acetazolamide and your other diuretics, you can waste magnesium. And so that's something you generally want to replace because your potassium is not going to get better until you replete magnesium.
So it sounds like mainly be careful with these pesky electrolytes, maybe reach for the RAS inhibitors or spironolactone as our friends here. And of course, watch that volume status, especially when you're turning on these boosters.
After all that, let's say you try everything and your patient's still not urinating much and your attending's like, find renal, this patient needs dialysis.
I hope I never say find renal, but kind of reminds me of like those Dr. Gluck and Plekin skits, like with the cardiologist nephrologist showdowns.
Yeah, I love those. And I'm just thinking about the nephrologist holding the salt bag and look.
Yeah, I was just thinking about that too. Yeah.
Hopefully the real world has some more peaceful interactions.
Right, exactly. Okay, so when should we think about dialysis or ultrafiltration in the grand scheme of things? You know, I do often see it as like a last line when patients are not responding, but I don't know if there's a role earlier.
The hesitation is it's not a benign thing to put somebody on dialysis, right? You have hemodynamic issues with dialysis. You know, it's less common, but you can have issues with catheter placement and complications that come with that. And then again, if we borrow from other literature, it's more likely that they're dependent on dialysis at 6 months. And dialysis sucks for patients. In my opinion, if I have tools to get their own kidneys to get rid of this excess fluid, I want to maximize those options before I go to dialysis. That doesn't mean we don't have those patients where we've tried everything.
I think that's a great reminder about what we sometimes put our patients through.
It's also a good reminder that dialysis is not a benign treatment. And I think doing everything possible before turning there fits with what I've generally seen.
Yeah. So let's put this all together when we're managing diuretic resistance. I think first and foremost, we should ask ourselves, is there enough kidney perfusion? Because diuretics won't work if they're not reaching the kidneys, right? And some of those common things could be a low flow state like cardiogenic shock or increased intra-abdominal pressure from ascites.
Right. And once you're confident that kidney perfusion's not an issue, there are 3 more common boosters you can reach for. The thiazides are usually our first line and include metolazone or chlorothiazide. Tolazone is much longer acting and cheaper, and there's been no difference in effectiveness that's really been shown. But chlorothiazide is IV, so some do prefer it for faster action and to not risk any absorption issues.
And with that, acetazolamide also has made a reappearance onto the scene. It sounds like it's a great agent to think about adding on as early as well, especially if alkalosis or COPD may be an issue. But remember, with all these boosters, right, we have to be careful with electrolytes, especially as potassium might encourage some diuretic resistance.
And finally, let's talk about ultrafiltration. In practice, it's usually used once all the other options have been exhausted because of some of the existing studies, and also that dialysis initiation has its own risks. That said, I think there are some people that are still exploring the role of earlier UF, but there's not much that's been really widely established about that. All right, so for Miss CR, we're finally able to add some metolazone and acetazolamide. Thankfully, she's starting to feel better without needing dialysis. Her creatinine's downtrending, and it's down to the low mid twos, but it's not quite back to her baseline when she's leaving the hospital.
Yes, and this may be a good place to talk about CKD management. This brings us back to a throwback and for some safe repetition from the GDMT Part 2 episode on heart failure meds and CKD.
So we completely underutilize these out of fear of people's underlying kidney function. We need to recognize that these are the best medications we have to actually keep people off dialysis.
So as a refresher and a throwback to that episode, in CKD stage 3, you should absolutely try to get the RAS inhibitor and SGLT2 inhibitors on board. It's good both for the heart as well as for proteinuria kidney disease, but it can get trickier, especially when the eGFRs start creeping into the CKD 4 range.
And so right now what we have is that to initiate an SGLT2 inhibitor, the studies show that as long as your eGFR is above 20, that you should go ahead or it's appropriate to initiate. The issue with that is that doesn't mean that starting at lower eGFRs is wrong. It just means it hasn't been studied yet.
For me, the biggest teaching from that episode is that it's safe to continue the SGLT2 inhibitor, even if the GFR drops below 20, right? As long as the patient's not having any issues.
Right. And it's a similar story as CKD progresses to not stop RAS inhibitors.
We have data to show that there's no reason to discontinue RAS inhibitors if somebody's already on it, irregardless of what their eGFR is. So even if it falls into that CKD4, CKD5 range, that was the STOP ACE study, which showed that strategy didn't impact hastening of dialysis. Whether it's helpful, it's not clear. So we're left with a lot of propensity match studies, observational studies, other studies that show that there probably is cardiovascular benefit to continuing those RAS inhibitors. Unfortunately, the STOP-A study wasn't powered to look at that variable. My strategy is, unless I'm dealing with potassium issues, to keep them on those agents.
And as a throwback to another CoreM episode we had on hyperkalemia, we can also think about using potassium binders to help balance out the potassium to try to keep that RAS inhibitor on. My go-to potassium binder is Lokelma, sodium zirconium psilocycosylate. It's easy to take and tasteless.
And one of my favorite things to do is to start the SGLT2 inhibitors with the RAS inhibitors and MRAs, since SGLT2s can be protective against serious hyperkalemia.
Oh yeah, good pro tip. And speaking of the mineralocorticoid receptor antagonists, the MRAs, I do hear about finerenone making an appearance on the scene. I think it's a more selective MRA than the non-steroidal MRA that we know with spironolactone, and it's shown to cause less hyperkalemia. Andrew, what do you know about it?
Yeah, I think I've heard the same thing. Sure, that potassium issue definitely makes it more appealing. Finerenone's been shown to slow CKD progression and proteinuric diabetic kidney disease. I think especially here, I've seen a lot of the nephrologists at the diabetes center start using finerenone almost as a third line if there's still a lot of protein in the urine, even after maxing out the RAS and the SGLT2.
Yeah, so it sounds like there's going to be more studies in the future whether finerenone is going to be like a proven GDMT med in heart failure. So more things to look out for.
Yeah, for sure. I think it'd be really exciting if it becomes established for heart failure on its own. Just to throw it out there too, I think the next things in the pipeline, maybe the GLP-1s are favorite obesity and diabetes meds, which may have some benefit for heart and kidney disease, even outside of diabetes.
So many good developments in the world of CKD and heart failure, and I'm glad our patients are getting that attention and research.
So to recap all of this, with most of these heart failure GDMT meds, we can and should continue RAS inhibitors, SGLT2s, and MRAs as CKD progresses, since they're protective for both organs. The main thing to look out for really is potassium issues, not the creatinine. There are some different GFR cutoffs for initiation of these meds, but these are rapidly evolving, and it's generally safe to continue at least the RAS inhibitors and the SGLT2s if they've already been started.
And on that note, that is a wrap for today's episode. Please share this with any colleague or anyone else you think might find this helpful.
Thank you to our reviewers, Dr. Nisha Bansal and Dr. Sanu Thomas from the University of Washington. This episode was also made in part from the digital education track at BIDMC. So we'd like to thank, obviously, Shreya, our other host here, as well as Dr. Adam Rodman and my co-residents who are in the track. Thank you to all the mentors involved in the work.
Awesome, Andrew. Thank you. And then thank you to Dr. Bhatia for the audio editing, as well as Dr. Rahul Maheshwarya for the infographic. Opinions expressed are our own and do not represent the opinions of any affiliated institution. Thank you.